This is the listening part of the ACERT exam held at Poznan University of Technology. You are going to do two separate listening tasks. The recordings will be played twice. Now turn to task one. You have 60 seconds to look at the content of this task.
Last week, Inside Science dedicated the entire episode to the lunar missions taking place this year. And it's not just our moon coming under scientific scrutiny. Also launching this October is a mission to one of Jupiter's moons, Europa. Jupiter has 95 moons, but Europa is arguably the most exciting because it looks like a place that might sustain life. This mission aims to find out. At NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, Jenny Kempmeyer is the science systems engineer on the Europa Clipper mission, the largest craft NASA has ever built for a planetary expedition. So just how large is that?
With its solar arrays deployed, it's about 30 meters.
That's massive.
Quite large. and the main body of the spacecraft is quite large as well. It's about 15 feet tall. And it's about, I think, 6,000 kilograms on launch.
That which is heavy.
Quite heavy.
So it's going to unfurl itself into this 30-meter extravaganza.
Exactly. So when it's launched, the solar panels are folded up, and after we launch the spacecraft and it's in space, those solar panels unfold like an accordion and they become that large 30-meter wingspan. But on launch, it has to obviously fit inside of a rocket, so it gets quite small. And there are some other pieces of the spacecraft that deploy as well. We have a couple of antennas that deploy and covers of instruments that need to come off. So there are other things that happen as well once we're in space.
Okay, so that's a lot of engineering. What's it all in aid of?
Yeah, so the exciting thing about where we're going, this moon of Jupiter called Europa, is that Europa is just a fascinating, fascinating place. So it's about the size of our moon, the Earth's moon, but it looks nothing like it. Europa is a icy ocean world. So it is a frozen ball of ice, but underneath that ice, we know that there is a global liquid saltwater ocean. It's about twice as much water as what we have on the Earth. So that's very exciting to me. It's a place in our solar system that actually contains liquid water right now. And so Europa Clipper is going to be going there to study this world and to understand a bit better what's going on there. What's, how much water is there exactly? How thick is the ice? Is this a habitable environment? And it's exciting to me that this is something that is in our solar system that we can actually send a spacecraft to and go study.
That sounds like a fantastic environment, a watery moon, twice as much water as we have on Earth. And you mentioned, is it habitable? Tell me more.
Yeah, so unlike some missions that are maybe a life detection mission, Europa Clipper is going to assess whether or not this moon Europa is habitable. Is it a habitable environment? And what we really mean by that is it a place that could support life? Does it have the right conditions? We think it does. So in addition to this kind of large ocean of liquid water, we believe that Europa has the right chemical elements for life, such as carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, sulfates. So we know that, you know, it has this huge ocean of liquid water, and we believe it has the right chemical elements. We also believe that Europa has the potential energy sources that would be needed to support life, perhaps from radiation processes, hydrothermal systems at the bottom of the ocean, as well as heat that's generated through a process called tidal flexing. In addition, we also think that the ocean on Europa has been there for about the age of the solar system, so that this habitable environment could have been kind of simmering away for about 4 billion years. And that element of time gives that environment time to develop. And so one of the things we are really trying to understand is, are all of those things true? To what extent are they true? And we want to characterize them as much as we can to understand if this is a habitable place.
So slow cooking, long slow cooking, that's what you need for life.
Exactly. And all of the right ingredients, you know, the water, the chemistry, and the energy.
Why haven't you designed a mission that just gets down onto the surface and scoops up some of the water and tests directly if there's life in there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So some of it is an engineering answer, which is that it is very difficult to land on another body, another planet, or another moon. And Europa is still a bit of a mystery to us. We don't have high-resolution imagery of every part of Europa yet. There are parts that we don't have photos of. And so we know a lot about this moon from previous scientific exploration, but there's still a lot that we don't know. And so to jump from the knowledge that we have right now to a landed mission would be kind of a huge leap in risk and in engineering. And so doing this kind of, you know, a reconnaissance mission where we're flying by repeatedly.
Last week, Inside Science dedicated the entire episode to the lunar missions taking place this year. And it's not just our moon coming under scientific scrutiny. Also launching this October is a mission to one of Jupiter's moons, Europa. Jupiter has 95 moons, but Europa is arguably the most exciting because it looks like a place that might sustain life. This mission aims to find out. At NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, Jenny Kempmeyer is the science systems engineer on the Europa Clipper mission, the largest craft NASA has ever built for a planetary expedition. So just how large is that?
With its solar arrays deployed, it's about 30 meters.
That's massive.
Quite large. and the main body of the spacecraft is quite large as well. It's about 15 feet tall. And it's about, I think, 6,000 kilograms on launch.
That is heavy.
Quite heavy.
So it's going to unfurl itself into this 30-meter extravaganza.
Exactly. So when it's launched, the solar panels are folded up. And after we launch the spacecraft and it's in space, those solar panels unfold like an accordion and they become that large 30 meter wingspan. But on launch, it has to obviously fit inside of a rocket, so it gets quite small. And there are some other pieces of the spacecraft that deploy as well. We have a couple of antennas that deploy and covers of instruments that need to come off. So there are other things that happen as well once we're in space.
Okay, so that's a lot of engineering. What's it all in aid of?
Yeah, so the exciting thing about where we're going, this moon of Jupiter called Europa, is that Europa is just a fascinating, fascinating place. So it's about the size of our moon, the Earth's moon, but it looks nothing like it. Europa is a icy ocean world. So it is a frozen ball of ice, but underneath that ice, we know that there is a global liquid saltwater ocean. It's about twice as much water as what we have on the Earth. So that's very exciting to me. It's a place in our solar system that actually contains liquid water right now. And so Europa Clipper is going to be going there to study this world and to understand a bit better what's going on there. What's, you know, how much water is there exactly? How thick is the ice? Is this a habitable environment? And it's exciting to me that this is something that is in our solar system that we can actually send a spacecraft to and go study.
That sounds like a fantastic environment, a watery moon, twice as much water as we have on Earth. And you mentioned, is it habitable? Tell me more.
Yeah, so unlike some missions that are maybe a life detection mission, Europa Clipper is going to assess whether or not this moon Europa is habitable. Is it a habitable environment? And what we really mean by that is it a place that could support life? Does it have the right conditions? We think it does. So in addition to this kind of large ocean of liquid water, we believe that Europa has the right chemical elements for life, such as carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, sulfates. So we know that, you know, it has this huge ocean of liquid water, and we believe it has the right chemical elements. We also believe that Europa has the potential energy sources that would be needed to support life, perhaps from radiation processes, hydrothermal systems at the bottom of the ocean, as well as heat that's generated through a process called tidal flexing. In addition, we also think that the ocean on Europa has been there for about the age of the solar system, so that this habitable environment could have been kind of simmering away for about 4 billion years. And that element of time gives that environment time to develop. And so one of the things we are really trying to understand is, are all of those things true? To what extent are they true? And we want to characterize them as much as we can to understand if this is a habitable place.
So slow cooking, long slow cooking, that's what you need for life.
Exactly. And all of the right ingredients, you know, the water, the chemistry, and the energy.
Why haven't you designed a mission that just gets down onto the surface and scoops up some of the water and tests directly if there's life in there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So some of it is an engineering answer, which is that it is very difficult to land on another body, another planet, or another moon. And Europa is still a bit of a mystery to us. We don't have high-resolution imagery of every part of Europa yet. There are parts that we don't have photos of. And so we know a lot about this moon from previous scientific exploration, but there's still a lot that we don't know. And so to jump from the knowledge that we have right now to a landed mission would be kind of a huge leap in risk and in engineering. And so doing this kind of, you know, a reconnaissance mission where we're flying by repeatedly.
This is the end of task one. Now turn to task two. You have 60 seconds to look at the content of this task.
Now, we've heard a lot lately about fake news, which is going up the agenda with claims that it's misleading the public and it could even be compromising elections. And despite many people being aware of the problem, it's not going away. So why is it so prolific? Filippo Mensa from Indiana University has made it his mission to find out, and Tom Crawford heard how.
So here what we wanted to look at was, even if we assumed people can do a good job recognizing high-quality information from low-quality information, and further, that they prefer to select and share high-quality information, how does then this play in the broader dynamics of social media? In other words, is good quality information likely to go viral more than junk and fake news. And so we built a model to study that particular question.
What did you find out then? Was the high-quality information more likely to go viral?
Well, the short answer shortly is no. So we looked at two particular factors in our model. One is how much information is produced, which determines the information load that people experience. So if a lot of information, if a lot of things are posted, then people get a lot of stuff in their feeds and they can't possibly, you know, pay attention to all of it. And on the other side, on the consumption side, we modeled how many things people are capable of paying attention to. We have finite attention, and all of this information is competing for our limited attention. When we make realistic assumptions about these quantities, these limits, then what the model shows is that low-quality information is just as likely to go viral as high-quality information. Statistically, we cannot distinguish between the popularity signatures of low and high quality information.
And what about things such as bots? So I remember reading something, I think it was Katy Perry had reached 100 million followers on Twitter, but then actually reading the article in detail, it was saying that up to half of these are believed to just be fake accounts or bots. Are they also playing a role in spreading fake news?
Yes, people who are running fake news websites are also using bots to amplify the visibility of their posts, whether to monetize it and make a financial gain through ads or simply to manipulate public opinion. Creating bots, even pretty sophisticated ones that are hard to tell from real humans, is relatively simple. And we have found that they are extremely effective at pushing fake news to go viral. So they create the impression that many people are paying attention to it, which makes people curious to see what it's about. And so this then creates a loop by which they are able to generate a sort of a cascade.
How can we then try and stop this? Or how can we tell if some account is a bot?
It is a hard task, and it is getting harder because bots are becoming more sophisticated. We've been working on machine learning algorithms to detect social bots for a few years now, and in the early stages, bots were pretty simple. They just automatically tweeted or retweeted, and you could see their patterns, and you could recognize them from, you know, long names and numbers and so on. But now we find much more sophisticated bots that are driven by humans. Very often the content itself is generated by a human, but instead of being posted on one account, it is posted on 1,000 or 10,000 accounts. And then these accounts follow each other and follow other people and respond and reply to humans so that they create networks that make it quite difficult to detect them.
So don't believe everything that you see on Twitter, unless it's from @NakedScientists, of course. That was Filippo Mensa, and his work was published. Now, we've heard a lot lately about fake news, which is going up the agenda with claims that it's misleading the public and it could even be compromising elections. And despite many people being aware of the problem, it's not going away. So why is it so prolific? Filippo Mensa from Indiana University has made it his mission to find out, and Tom Crawford heard how.
So here what we wanted to look at was, even if we assumed people can do a good job recognizing high-quality information from low-quality information, and further that they prefer to select and share high-quality information, how does then this play in the broader dynamics of social media? In other words, is good quality information likely to go viral more than junk and fake news? And so we built a model to study that particular question.
What did you find out then? Was the high quality information more likely to go viral?
Well, the short answer shortly is no. So we looked at two particular factors in our model. One is how much information is produced, which determines the information load that people experience. So if a lot of information, if a lot of things are posted, then people get a lot of stuff in their feeds and they can't possibly, you know, pay attention to all of it. And on the other side, on the consumption side, we modeled how many things people are capable of paying attention to. We have finite attention, and all of this information is competing for our limited attention. When we make realistic assumptions about these quantities, these limits, then what the model shows is that low-quality information is just as likely to go viral as high-quality information. Statistically, we cannot distinguish between the popularity signatures of low and high-quality information.
And what about things such as bots? So I remember reading something, I think it was Katy Perry had reached 100 million followers on Twitter, but then actually reading the article in detail, it was saying that up to half of these are believed to just be fake accounts or bots. Are they also playing a role in spreading fake news?
Yes, people who are running fake news websites are also using bots to amplify the visibility of their posts, whether to monetize it and make a financial gain through ads or simply to manipulate public opinion. Creating bots, even pretty sophisticated ones that are hard to tell from real humans, is relatively simple. And we have found that they are extremely effective at pushing fake news to go viral. So they create the impression that many people are paying attention to it, which makes people curious to see what it's about. And so this then creates a loop by which they are able to generate a sort of a cascade.
How can we then try and stop this? Or how can we tell if some account is a bot?
It is a hard task, and it is getting harder because bots are becoming more sophisticated. We've been working on machine learning algorithms to detect social bots for a few years now. And in the early stages, bots were pretty simple. They just automatically tweeted or retweeted, and you could see their patterns, and you could recognize them from, you know, long names and numbers and so on. But now we find much more sophisticated bots that are driven by humans. Very often the content itself is generated by a human, but instead of being posted on one account, it is posted on 1,000 or 10,000 accounts. And then these accounts follow each other and follow other people and respond and reply to humans so that they create networks that make it quite difficult to detect them.
So don't believe everything that you see on Twitter, unless it's from @NakedScientists, of course. That was Filippo Mensa, and his work was published.
This is the end of Task 2.